Geekscape.com.
Hello and welcome to Aryan Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and today's narration is from the History of the Kings of Britain. And this was written by Geoffrey of Monmouth. And this is part one. Brutus occupies the island of Albion. Britain, the best of islands, is situated in the Western Ocean, between France and Ireland. It stretches for 800 miles in length, and for 200 in breadth. It provides in unfailing plenty everything that is suited to the use of human beings. It abounds in every kind of mineral. It has broad fields and hillsides, which are suitable for the most intensive farming, and in which, because of the richness of the soil, all kinds of crops are grown in their seasons. It also has open woodlands, which are filled with every kind of game. Through its forest glades stretch pasture lands, which provide the various feeding stuffs needed by cattle. And there, too, grow flowers of every hue, which offer their honey to the flitting bees. At the foot of its windswept mountains, it has meadows green with grass, beauty spots where clear springs flow into shining streams, which ripple gently and murmur an assurance of deep sleep to those lying on their banks. What is more, it is watered by lakes and rivers full of fish, and at its southern end by a narrow strait across which men sail to France. There are three noble rivers, the Thames, the Severn, and the Humber, and these it stretches out, as though they were three arms. Into them, goods from across the ocean are carried, merchandise coming from all countries by this same sea traffic. In earlier times, Britain was graced by 28 cities. Some of these, in the depopulated areas, are now mouldering away, with their walls broken. Others remain whole and have in them the shrines of saints, with towers built up to a noble height, where whole companies of men and women offer praise to God, according to the Christian tradition. Lastly, Britain is inhabited by five races of people: the Norman French, the Britons, the Saxons, the Picts, and the Scots. Of these, the Britons once occupied the land from sea to sea, before the others came. Then the vengeance of God overtook them, because of their arrogance, and they submitted to the Picts and the Saxons. It now remains for me to tell how they came and from where, and this will be made clear in what follows. After the Trojan War, Aeneas fled from the ruined city with his son Ascanius and came by boat to Italy. He was honourably received there by King Latinus, but Turnus, king of the Rutuli, became jealous of him and attacked him. In the battle between them, Aeneas was victorious. Turnus was killed, and Aeneas seized both the kingdom of Italy and the person of Lavinia, who was the daughter of Latinus. When Aeneas' last day came, Ascanius was elected king. He founded the town of Alba on the bank of the Tiber, and became the father of a son called Silvius. This Silvius was involved in a secret love affair with a certain niece of Lavinia's. He married her and made her pregnant. When this came to the knowledge of his father Ascanius, the latter ordered his soothsayers to discover the sex of the child which the girl had conceived. As soon as they had made sure of the truth of the matter, the soothsayers said that she would give birth to a boy who would cause the death of both his father and his mother, and that after he had wandered in exile through many lands, this boy would eventually rise to the highest honour. The soothsayers were not wrong in their forecast. When the day came for her to have her child, the mother bore a son and died in childbirth. The boy was handed over to the midwife and was given the name Brutus. At last, when 15 years had passed, the young man killed his father by an unlucky shot with an arrow when they were out hunting together. Their beaters drove some stags into their path, and Brutus, who was under the impression that he was aiming his weapon at these stags, hit his own father below the breast. As the result of this death, Brutus was expelled from Italy by his relations, who were angry with him for having committed such a crime. He went into exile to certain parts of Greece, and there he discovered the descendants of Helenus, Priam's son, who were held captive in the power of Pandrasus, king of the Greeks. After the fall of Troy, Pyrrhus, the son of Achilles, had dragged this man, Helenus, off with him in chains, and a number of other Trojans too. He had ordered them to be kept in slavery, so that he might take vengeance on them for the death of his father. When Brutus realized that these people were of the same race as his ancestors, he stayed some time with them. However, he soon gained such fame for his military skill and prowess that he was esteemed by the kings and princes more than any young man in the country. Among the wise, he was himself wise, and among the valiant, he too was valiant. All the gold and silver and the equipment which he acquired, he handed over to his soldiers. In this way, his fame spread among all peoples. The Trojans began to flock to him and to beg him to become their leader, so that they might be freed from their subjection to the Greeks. They said that this could easily be done, for they had now increased in number in the country to such an extent that there were reckoned to be 7,000 of them, not counting the women and children. What is more, there was a certain nobly born youth in Greece called Assaracus, who favoured their faction. He was the son of a Trojan mother, and he had the greatest faith in them, thinking that with their help he could resist the persecution of the Greeks. His own brother was harassing Assaracus on account of 3 castles which his dying father had given him, and was trying to take these away from him by alleging that he was the son of a concubine. This brother was Greek, on both his father's and his mother's side, and he had persuaded the king and the other Greeks to support his case. When Brutus saw how many men he now had, and realized that the castles of Assaracus were there for him to take, he agreed, without misgiving, to the request of the Trojans. Once Brutus had been promoted to the position of leader, he called the Trojans together from all sides and fortified the castles of Assaracus. Assaracus himself occupied the open woodlands and the hills with the entire force of men and women who supported him and Brutus. Then Brutus sent to the king a letter which read as follows. Brutus, the leader of those who survived the fall of Troy, sends his greeting to King Pandrasus. The people, sprung from the illustrious line of Dardanus, have withdrawn to the hidden depths of the forests, for they have found it intolerable that they should be treated in your kingdom otherwise than as the purity of their noble blood demands. They have preferred to keep themselves alive on flesh and herbs, as though they were wild beasts, and have their liberty, rather than remain under the yoke of your slavery, even if pampered there by every kind of wealth. If, in the pride of your power, this offends you, then you should not count it against them. Rather, you should pardon them, for it is the natural aim of everyone in captivity to strive to return to his former dignity. Be moved to pity for them, and deign to bestow upon them their lost liberty. Give them permission to inhabit the forest glades which they have occupied in their attempt to escape from slavery. If you cannot grant this, then let them, with your approval, go off to join the peoples of other lands. When the content of this letter was explained to him, Pandrasus was greatly surprised that people whom he had held in slavery should be so bold that they could send such messages to him. He summoned a council of his leaders and decided to collect an army and to pursue the Trojans. while he was searching the wastelands in the neighbourhood of the castle of Sparatinium, where he thought they were, Brutus made a sally with 3,000 men, and suddenly attacked when Pandrasus was least expecting anything of the sort. Having heard of the coming of Pandrasus, Brutus had entered this castle the night before, so that he might make a surprise attack on the Greeks, as they passed by unarmed and marching in broken order. The Trojans charged them, and attacked them fiercely, aiming at killing as many as they could. In their utter stupefaction, the Greeks fled in all directions. With the king at their head, they rushed to cross the river Acheron, which flowed nearby. As they forded the river, they were in grave danger from the whirling current of its waters. Brutus attacked them as they fled, and by his assault he slaughtered some of them in the river, and others on the bank. This double death which he was inflicting gave him immense pleasure, as he rushed to and fro in the battle. Antigonus, the brother of Pandrasus, was greatly distressed when he observed what was happening. He marshalled his scattered forces into formation, and then he turned and charged swiftly at the raging Trojans. He preferred to meet death while fighting, rather than turn in cowardly flight and be drowned in the muddy whirlpools of the river. He moved forward in close formation, and exhorted his men to resist bravely, and to hurl back with all their might the weapons which were causing such slaughter among them. This availed him little or nothing. The Trojans were fully equipped. Their enemies were virtually unarmed. Because of this, the Trojans pressed on all the more boldly, and the slaughter which they inflicted was very heavy. They continued to attack in this way, until almost all the Greeks were killed, and they had captured Antigonus and his comrade Anacletus. Once Brutus had made sure of victory, he garrisoned the fortress with 600 soldiers, and then set off for the hidden recesses of the forest groves, where the Trojan people were waiting for his help. Pandrasus, on the other hand, was upset by his own flight, and by the fact that his brother was captured, and spent that night in rallying his scattered forces. When the next day dawned, he set off with his reformed army to besiege the castle, for he imagined that Brutus had himself occupied it, taking with him Antigonus and the other captives whom he had seized. As soon as he reached the walls, Pandrasus reconnoitred the site of the castle, divided his army into troops, and stationed them at various places around the perimeter. Some he ordered to prevent those inside from coming out, some that they should cut off the watercourses which rivers, and others that with a great number of battering rams and other machines of war, they should shatter the fabric of the walls. They followed his instructions with good results, and strove with great zeal, and in every way they could imagine, to harass the besieged unmercifully. When night fell, they chose their bravest men to guard the camp, and their tents from any stealthy attack by the enemy, while the others, who were worn out by toil, enjoyed peaceful sleep. Those who were besieged stood on the top of the walls, and strove with might and main to repel the assault machines of the enemy with devices of their own. They struggled as one man to defend themselves by hurling down missiles and brimstone torches, and when the enemy constructed a testudo and dug underneath their walls, they used Greek fire and a deluge of boiling water to force them to retreat. In the end, suffering as they were from lack of food and from their day-long effort, they sent a messenger to Brutus to beg him to hasten to their assistance. They were afraid that they would become so weak that they would be compelled to abandon the fortress. Brutus wanted very much to bring help, but he was himself greatly preoccupied by the fact that he did not have enough fighting to join battle in the field. He relied instead upon a cunning plan, thinking that he would approach the enemy's camp in the night, and that once he had tricked their guards, he would slaughter them as they slept. However, this could not be achieved without the assent and the assistance of one of the Greeks. Brutus therefore summoned Anacletus, the comrade of Antigonus, drew his sword out of its scabbard, and said to him, My fine young friend, unless you agree faithfully to what I propose and carry out what I order you to do, this is the end of your life, and of that of Antigonus too. This coming night, I intend to attack the Greeks' camp, and to slaughter them when they least expect it. I am afraid that their sentinels may discover my intention, and so hinder my plan, in so far as it is necessary for me to attack their sentinels first. I want them to be deceived by your behaviour, so that I can come within striking distance of the others, in safety. You must carry out this cunning plan for me. Go to the besiegers in the second hour of the night, and allay their suspicion by lying to them. Say that you have freed Antigonus from where I held him prisoner, taken him to a valley in the woods, and hidden him there, among the bushes. Pretend that he is unable to go any further, because of the chains with which he is shackled. Then lead them to the edge of the glade, as if they are going to free him. I shall be there, with a band of armed men, ready to kill them. Anacletus was terrified by the sight of the sword, which threatened him with death all the time that Brutus was speaking. He swore that he would carry out this order, if only he himself, and Antigonus too, were allowed to live. The bargain was struck between them, and at the second hour of the night, which had already nearly come, he started on his way towards the siege as he had been ordered. When he finally came near to the camp, the sentinels, who were keeping a watchful eye on all the obscure spots in the neighbourhood, gathered around him on all sides. They asked him what he had come for, and if he was there to betray the army. He pretended to be overjoyed at seeing them, and answered them in this way. I am not here to betray my own people. I have escaped from the Trojans' prison. I beg you to come with me to your own Antigonus, whom I have rescued from the fetters of Brutus. He is hampered by the weight of his chains, and I have told him to stay hidden in the bushes a short distance back on the edge of the forest, until I could find some of you whom I could bring back to free him. They were not sure whether he was telling the truth or not, but one of their number appeared, who recognized Anacletus, greeted him, and told his companions who he was. They hesitated no longer, but called the others who were some way off to come quickly. They followed Anacletus to the wood, where, according to what he had said, Antigonus lay hidden. As they made their way through the bushes, Brutus attacked them with his armed bands. He charged at them, and, terrified as they were, he was able to inflict frightful slaughter upon them. Then he set out for the siege. He divided his comrades into three companies, and ordered each band to go to a different part of the camp, discreetly, and without making a sound. Once they were in position, they were not to kill anyone until he himself had seized the king's tent with his own troop. He would then blow his horn as a signal to them. When Brutus had told the Trojans what they were to do, they quietly and without more ado entered the camp. They occupied the various parts as he had ordered, and awaited the promised signal. As soon as he stood in front of the tent of Pandrasus, which he was burning to enter more than all the others, Brutus gave his men the signal without waiting any longer. The moment they heard it, they quickly drew their swords, went into the sleeping quarters of the unconscious enemy, and with deadly effect dealt blow after blow. In this way, the Trojans moved forwards throughout the camp, showing pity to no one. And the Greeks woke up at the groans of the dying, and when they set eye on those who were about to butcher them, they were stupefied, like sheep suddenly attacked by wolves. They saw no way of protecting themselves, for they had no time either to pick up their weapons or to take flight. Themselves unarmed, the Greeks ran to and fro between the armed men, wherever their panic led them. But all the time, they were being cut to pieces by the Trojans who were attacking them. Anyone who got away half alive was dashed against the rocks and the tree trunks as he rushed along in his desire for escape, and so gave up his soul together with his blood. Anyone who, protected only by his shield or by some other covering, rushed headlong through the pitch-dark night in fear of death and came upon these same rocks, fell there, and as he fell, his arms or legs were shattered. He who avoided both of these disasters was drowned in the rivers which flowed nearby, for he did not know where to flee. Hardly anyone escaped unhurt and without suffering some mishap. And what is more, as soon as they heard of the arrival of their comrades in arms, the Trojans inside the fortress hurried out and doubled the slaughter which was being inflicted. When Brutus had seized Pandrasus' tent, as we have said already, he was careful to tie the king up and keep him safe, for he knew that he would get what he wanted more easily by keeping Pandrasus alive than by killing him. On the other hand, those who had come with Brutus went on with the slaughter. In the part of the camp which had been allocated to each of them, they succeeded in killing everyone that they found. It was in this way that they passed the night, and the light of dawn revealed just how many of the people there they had destroyed. As a result, Brutus was beside himself with joy. When all the enemy had been slaughtered, he allowed his own men to deal as they wished with the spoils of those they had destroyed. He himself entered the fortress, taking the king with him, and waited while the royal treasure was being distributed. When everything had been shared out, he placed a new garrison in the fortress and ordered the dead to be buried. He then reassembled his troops and returned jubilant with victory to the depths of the forest. Their success filled his men's hearts with immense joy. Their illustrious leader called his elders together and asked them what ought to be demanded of Pandrasus. Now that the king was in their power, he would agree without reservation to any demand they might make, provided always that he were permitted to go free. They immediately began asking for all sorts of different things. Some begged Brutus to demand a part of Pandrasus' kingdom so that they could settle there. Others, on the contrary, asked for permission to emigrate and for whatever would be useful to them on their journey. When they had gone on vacillating for a long time, one of their number called Membritius stood up, called for silence, and spoke as follows while the others listened. "Why do you hesitate about the measures which, in my opinion, ought to be adopted for your future welfare? If you want a lasting peace for yourselves and for your heirs, one thing alone must be asked for: permission to depart. If you grant Pandrasus his life, on condition that he allows you to occupy a part of Greece and remain there among the descendants of Danaus, you will never enjoy lasting peace as long as the brothers, sons, and grandsons of those on whom you have inflicted decisive defeat remain intermingled with you or as your neighbours. They will always remember the slaughter of their relatives, and they will hate you forever. They will take offence at the merest trifles, and they will do all in their power to take vengeance. Since you command the smaller force, you will not have the strength to be able to resist the attacks of the local inhabitants. If any dispute should arise between you and them, their number will increase daily, while your own will get smaller. My advice, therefore, is that you should ask Pandrasus for the hand of his eldest daughter, whom they call Inigi, as a comfort to your leader. With her, you should ask for gold and silver, ships and grain, and everything else that you will need for your journey. If we can arrange all this, we should obtain the king's permission, and then sail away to other lands." When Membritius had finished his speech, which was longer than what I have recorded, the entire assembly agreed with him. They decreed that Pandrasus should be brought into their midst, and that, unless he agreed to what they demanded, he should be condemned to a most cruel death. He was led in straight away, and was placed on a seat higher than the others. When he had been told what tortures would be inflicted on him if he did not do the things that were demanded, he made the following reply: "Since the gods are hostile to me, and have delivered me and my brother Anacletus into your hands, I must obey your command, for if you meet with a refusal, we shall both lose our lives, which you have the power to give to us or to take away as you choose. I consider that there is nothing better or more enjoyable than life itself, It is not therefore to be wondered at if I am willing to purchase life with my material possessions. I obey your orders, although against my will. I take some comfort in the knowledge that I am about to give my daughter to a young man of such great prowess. The nobility which flourishes in him, and his fame, which is well known to us, show him to be of the true race of Priam and Anchises. Who other but he could have freed from their chains the exiles of Troy when they were enslaved by so many mighty princes? Who other but he could have led them in their resistance to the king of the Greeks, or have challenged in battle such a vast concourse of warriors with so few men, and led their king in chains in the very first engagement? Since so noble a young man has been able to resist me so courageously, I give him my daughter Inergy. I also give him gold and silver, ships and corn, and whatsoever you will consider necessary for his journey. If you change your present plan, and prefer to stay with the Greeks, then I grant you a third of my kingdom for you to live in. If not, then I will carry out my promises effectively, and in order that you may feel the more assured, I will remain a hostage in your hands until I have done so. As soon as this agreement was made, messengers were sent to all the shores of Greece to collect ships. When these were brought together, to the number of 324, they were handed over and loaded with every kind of grain. The daughter of Pandrasus was married to Brutus, and, according to what his rank demanded, each man was presented with gold and silver. Once all these things had been done, the king was set free from prison. The Trojans sailed away from his dominion with a following wind. Inergy stood on the high poop, and from time to time fell fainting in the arms of Brutus. She wept and sobbed at being forced to leave her relations and her homeland, and as long as the shore lay there before her eyes, she would not turn her gaze away from it. Brutus soothed and caressed her, putting his arms around her and kissing her gently. He did not cease his efforts until, worn out with crying, she fell asleep.
Radio Aryan.